Roll 2d6, show number 13. Welcome to Roll 2d6, with Adam and Nate, a podcast about games, gaming, and gamers.
Hi everyone, we are back from Deep Space with another exciting episode of Roll 2d6. I'm Adam.
And I'm Nate.
And we're going to boldly go where we haven't boldly gone since about episode 2, which is to talk about Star Trek, and specifically the history of Star Trek licensed games.
You know, even though we have talked a little bit about Star Trek licensed games way back in episode 2, that was so long ago, we are hoping that people have forgotten that we've spoken about that. We're going to take a slightly different tack this time.
That's right. This time we're talking specifically about role-playing games. Now, I'm a huge Star Trek fan, metaphorically, and I've liked just about every single incarnation of Star Trek that has come out.
Even the ones that sucked.
That's right, especially the one. That should tell you something.
It does.
So I was really interested to finally do some research into this and try to put together a full list of all the Star Trek role-playing games that have come out over the last 30 years. And I'm going to try not to miss anything, but there have been tons and tons of licensed Star Trek games over the years. So I'm hoping that I've found everything.
And again, we're concentrating on the Star Trek role-playing games, not every Star Trek licensed sort of Monopoly game that happens. We're talking about the role-playing games.
Star Trek Parcheesi. All right. We're also going to talk Star Trek Yahtzee. We're also going to talk about some of our own experiences playing some of these games and about the fork in the Star Trek universe when it comes to pen and paper RPGs.
Yes!
Thank you, sorry. Jabba. Yeah. So let's go way back in time, back to the original Star Trek series, which aired from 1966 to 1969. It's a great show, of course. What's your favorite episode, Nate?
Well, I'd like to just take a moment and wax lyrical about a couple of my
Please
favorites.
Do.
Two of my favorites of the original series show, and I'm a fan of the original series over the Next Generation, or in fact, anything that's been produced since the Next Generation. I still prefer the original campy series myself.
Oh, yeah.
But the two, it's sort of a toss-up between Devil in the Dark and Mirror Mirror.
Yes.
For those of you who don't know your Star Trek episode titles, Devil in the Dark is a basic murder mystery, which eventually you show is done by a monster, but you find out that the monster is indeed an intelligent being, and it's the Horta.
The Horta.
And it's like survival horror in space where you learn that the real monsters are man. and I happen to like that one a lot.
Damn it, Jim, I'm a doctor, not a bricklayer.
That's right. That's one of my favorite lines from that, and it's one of the few Jim, I'm a doctor, I'm a doctor, not a blank line. The other one is Mirror Mirror, which is an alternate universe. It's the Spock wearing the goatee. And alternate universes have always been intriguing to me, and this episode was used as a trope many times in most of the other Star Trek franchises, and also, I think, a couple of the novels.
Yeah, I think there was another novel where they went back to the Mirror Universe in Next Generation, and that was kind of interesting.
Yes.
I think among my favorites are Spectre of the Gun, which was the third season one where they're in sort of the spooky ghost town.
They shoot out at the OK Corral, without bullets.
Without bullets, and Spock has to mind meld all the guys and hypnotize them all into believing they can't be hurt by the bullets. I thought that was cool.
Yeah.
And then the Doomsday Machine, which featured the Doomsday Machine. And Spock's brain, which I liked.
Featured Spock's brain. Oh, no, it didn't.
They were searching
Spock's
for his brain.
That's
and
right.
I like that one just for wackiness, particularly the fact that they have a little remote control they use to walk Spock around.
You know, I wish I had one of those for my kids. I could put one of those in there and make them go clean up their room.
That's right. Now, a few years after Star Trek was canceled in 69, there was a short-lived Star Trek animated series, which was called, unimaginatively, Star Trek the Animated Series.
Yes.
And it ran from 73 to 74. Now, I like the animated series. Probably not that great of a show, but I like it. And it's the only Star Trek show that has yet to come out on DVD.
Ah.
Yeah. And, you know, in doing the research for this, I actually checked on TVshowsOnDVD.com, an excellent website for this, and it is scheduled for release in November of 2006, so I am very excited. I know what I'm asking for Christmas.
Wow, your wish will be fulfilled.
That's right.
You'll be able to see the Edoan Navigator all over again.
You know, they only had him because of budgetary reasons. They couldn't pay for
Walter Koenig.
Walter Koenig, yeah.
There you go.
Sad but true. And I also found out that the old Dungeons & Dragons show is also coming out on DVD in November.
Oh, all right.
So the one with Willie Ames. So I'm excited about that. Maybe we should do another a different podcast where I can just wax on about my favorite cartoons from the 70s and 80s.
All right. If we do another parallel podcast about these cartoons, we'll be sure to let you know.
That's
but
right.
We should definitely do a Dungeons & Dragons cartoon role-playing game segment.
That would be fun. I always wanted to come up with stats for all the characters in that. I'm sure it's probably out there on the net already.
Yes, another 400 people have done it, but that won't stop us from reinventing the wheel.
I'll just read their wheel designs. So anyway, after the animated series was canceled, there was, of course, still lots of interest in the series. Fans were creating their own publications. They were having some of the first Star Trek conventions, and in 1975, Franz Josef published a book called The Star Trek Starfleet Technical Manual, which I have a copy of right here, Nate.
Yeah, I know. I'm perusing it. It's one of my favorite oldie-timey books.
Yes, and it's full of all kinds of schematics and deck plans and ship diagrams and pictures and lists of names of all the various types of ships. And it's all, of course, set in the original series. And I have the 1986 reprinting from the Star Trek 20th anniversary, which is now 12 years in the past.
That's right.
Wow.
Wow, so it should have been, yeah, well.
I feel old. I loved looking through this book, and I still do. I love seeing all the lists of starship names and deck plans, and there's even patterns for the uniforms and everything.
Yeah, so if you wanted to sew your own, you have all of the plans.
So I'll come back to that book in a minute, but it is important for certain of the Star Trek RPGs.
Yes.
Now, soon after that came out in 1975... a few years later, in 1978, there was a company called Heritage Models, which was formerly a maker of miniatures for fantasy games, and they got a license from Paramount to make a Star Trek role-playing game. Now, role-playing games were still pretty new in 1978.
Right.
So they called their game Star Trek Adventure Gaming in the Final Frontier.
Wow. You know, that's a really long name for a role-playing game.
It is. Well, they didn't have the benefit of modern marketing specialists and focus groups.
I'm surprised that they didn't call it, maybe S&T to try to go after Dungeons & Dragons. Star and Trek, I don't know.
I don't think hardly anyone knew what Dungeons & Dragons even was at that time, I think.
That's true.
But so according to some of the research I did, this was actually the first time that a game company had licensed another property for a role-playing game. So.
Wow.
There you go, the first licensed RPG. They also produced a game called John Carter, Warlord of Mars, which was based on the Edgar Rice Burroughs series of Mars novels. You ever read any of those?
Oh, yeah, the Barsoom.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah, those are great, and I think they're in the public domain. I wonder,
I think
were
they
in the public
yeah.
domain in the 70s?
They might have been. I'm not sure if they had to actually get a license for that or not. But
yeah, that's the best kind of content to use.
That's right.
That's in the public domain.
Look forward to my Beowulf RPG coming out next quarter. Anyway, I haven't been able to find out much information about this first Star Trek game other than its name and a few paragraphs about it on Memory Alpha, which is the big Star Trek wiki. And apparently it used a D6 rolling system that was similar to the first edition Shadowrun, where you would have a dice pool, you roll dice, and if you get a 6, you get to re-roll it, and it turns into a 6
a
plus whatever you get. Yeah,
you count up successes, and that determines whatever it is you're going for.
So it was based on the original series and the animated series, so it did have the Xinti and stuff like that.
Wow.
I don't know what happened to Heritage, but I guess they're not around anymore.
They have no web presence that Google could tell us.
That's right. So the next year, that was in 1978. The next year, another very important license to the Star Trek RPG history was granted by Paramount to another game company, Task Force Games.
Ah, the venerable Task Force Games.
Yes, and they are the makers of Starfleet Battles, which has been around for forever. Well, since 1979.
The venerable Starfleet Battles.
Yes. Now, their license is based on the Star Trek universe as it was in 1979, and that's the license they still have. They must have gotten a really ironclad contract. Because it's never going to be revoked, so they say on their website.
And they have done so many weird and odd things with it that I'm sure that that Paramount is trying really hard to find a way to revoke it. But
you would think
can't.
So.
Armies of lawyers beating on it, trying to get it revoked.
But they have, it's based on the original series, the animated series. So they have, and it's also based on a lot of the concepts from the Star Trek Starfleet Technical Manual that I mentioned earlier.
Right, which was not actually, as we know, wasn't created by Paramount or any of the actual people involved. It was a fan production,
It was Franz Josef. He had asked Gene Roddenberry for permission to publish this, and he put it all together. And Gene Roddenberry said, "Hey, cool."
Yeah, that's right. So essentially they're using as the Starfleet Battles universe uses as canon ideas from the original series plus the fan-created and fan-explained portions from the Starfleet Technical Manual.
Yeah, that's right. According to their license that Task Force Games got, they're not allowed to refer to any of the characters or detailed events of the original series, so you won't find Kirk or Spock in any of those books.
Or Talos 7.
Or Talos 7 or anything like that. But they have the Federation and
Earth?
Things like that. I think they can mention Earth. I think almost anything can mention Earth. It's hard to, you can't trademark that anymore. After Earth versus Paramount in 1973, they revealed you could not trademark that. But Starfleet Battles is, of course, a fine tactical combat game with starships of the timeline of the original series, Federation, Klingons. And as time has gone on, since 1979... they have expanded the universe quite a bit. They've added a whole bunch of new races, new history, and their universe, they call the Starfleet universe, is quite different from the canon history of Star Trek. But that's fine. They've diverged, and it's their own whole sort of world now.
Right. One of the most interesting things I like about that world is the introduction of the Kzinti, which were a creation of Larry Niven's Known Space, the cat-like warriors. The Kzinti made an appearance on the animated series, because one of the episodes of the animated series stole an entire plot line and characters from a Larry Niven story.
That's right.
Called The Slaver Weapon. And in doing this, they sort of introduced this. It was sort of cross-pollinating these science fiction universes, and the Kzinti got caught up in the Starfleet universe.
They did, and now they're forever part of
That's right. They're forever
Starfleet
part of
battles.
Task Force Games' Starfleet universe, yes.
You know, I read on Wikipedia about the animated series. The episode that had the Kzinti, they all had pink jumpsuits. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
And supposedly that was because the animation director for that episode was colorblind, and he did not realize they were pink.
Oh, that's funny.
I think he would have wanted.
I thought they
something
were just
else.
Very secure in their felinity or masculine. I don't know what they have.
Well, anyway, Task Force Games, the Starfleet universe. There are a few RPGs that have been made over the years based on that universe, opposed to the canon Paramount-based Star Trek universe. So I'll get back to those when we get to them in the timeline.
Right.
So after this, in 1982, Paramount granted a Star Trek RPG license to FOSSA, which, of course, I know mainly as the publisher of BattleTech and Shadowrun First Edition, which you and I played a whole lot of.
Oh, yes. Many years of my life worth of that.
That's right. Now, their game was called Star Trek the Role-Playing Game.
Another fine name for role-playing game.
You know, it says what it is.
That's right. And 10 out of 10 for clarity.
That's right. And they eventually released a whole bunch of source books for it. They also released the Star Trek Starship Tactical Combat Simulator, which is a tactical combat board game for battling starships, kind of like Starfleet Battles, except I think a whole lot simpler.
A whole lot simpler, and it's near and dear to my heart. I think we've talked about it before.
We have played it before.
I have a soft spot for it.
We love it despite its many serious flaws.
That's right.
So FOSSA kept this license from Paramount for quite a while. And they released a whole bunch of books. They had source books for Romulans, Klingons, and even they had a Star Trek III source book, a Star Trek IV source book.
That's right. A couple of these are all sitting in front of you today.
I see them right here. You pulled out the Star Trek IV source book.
And I actually left my Klingon and Romulan source books and ship recognition guides for the Starfleet Tactical Combat Simulator in the other room. But I have a stack about 10 inches high of all the stuff that FAS has come out with that I've managed to pick up over the years.
Oh, yes. And these are great just for Star Trek source material if you're into that stuff,
oh,
which
absolutely.
Of course I am.
Of course.
So, and they released even a couple of Next Generation source books. Those were their final products in 1988 and 1989.
That's
and
right.
We have the Next Generation Officer's Manual right here.
Right. I have one of those, and I found it to be very interesting. As a matter of fact, during that time, at the very end of FAS's license on the game, in some of the game magazines at the time, there were people running articles about the Next Generation and putting it into FAS's game system, and I picked up a bunch of those articles as well out of the game magazines where people had come up with some character classes and skills that were reflected in the Next Generation that were not in the original game, and so little sort of fan expansions or game magazine expansions on it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. As they saw stuff in the show, they would come up with stats for it. And I had heard that, and I'm not sure if this is apocryphal or not, but I had heard that this Next Generation Officer's Manual, which was their first source book for Next Generation, was actually given to people who were writers for the show as their Bible.
Oh,
for
really?
The show. Yes.
If it wasn't true, it makes a great yarn, and I want to believe it.
So if you're writing for the show and you're like, wow, how far away can you transport? You can actually look and say, oh, I can transport 40,000 kilometers with the ship's transporters.
Wow.
And then you know that.
See, that'd be great.
And the sad thing is I knew that off the top of my head. So next, let's see. So that license ended in 1989, and we'll get to the next licensee after that.
Right. As far as I'm concerned, I think that was the saddest loss of a license because I happened to... Well, it happened to be the one that I bought and followed, so I was not happy to watch it all go away.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And then have to rebuy all the GameStop.
Yeah, definitely. After that, in 1993, Task Force Games released their first Star Trek RPG, which was called Prime Directive. And this was, of course, still from the Starfleet Battles license, and so it was set in the time period of the original series. And they used their own custom system, and you have this one, right, Nate?
I do. I bought this one and one of the expansion books to it. I have the 1993 one. Prime Directive does indeed use their own system, but it's one you might recognize. It's a dice pool system with a target number. You roll your number of dice in the dice pool for any number, for whichever skill. You count up the number of successes or the number of dice that come up to the target number or greater, and that tells you whether or not you have a botched failure, a marginal success, or whatnot, and you get through it. It's a fairly simple and well-recognized sort of system now. The most interesting thing about the system is how the game is essentially diverged from the canon.
Oh, yeah.
And it is perpetually in the old show era, even though the rest of the franchise has moved on. So as you watch and you sort of keep up with Star Trek through the years, and you've gone through all the Next Generation, all the things after that, technology's increased, and everyone sort of looks back at the old shows, oh, that's so quaint. And then you get into Prime Directive, and you're smack dab in the middle of the old show universe, and I think that's the most interesting bit.
Oh, yeah, they're never out of that, and they just keep publishing more and more stuff.
That's right, that's right. And I bought this game and the Federation source book never intending to play. I knew for a fact
read,
I would never play. I wanted to read it. I was fascinated by the idea of having a non... I wanted to see a non-Star Trek Star Trek game, and this is the only one there is. So I decided to buy it. And I really like the Federation as presented in the Starfleet universe, the Starfleet Battles universe, as much as or better than the ones in the post-Next Generation era products.
Mm-hmm.
The Starfleet Battles universe, or Prime Directive Federation, is a real regional power. It has goals, aims, enemies, and a whole heck of a lot of phasers. And the,
that's right.
And this is a marked contrast to the post-Next Generation era of the Federation, where they have a whole heck of a lot of diplomats. And a whole heck of a lot of giant, huge, floating cruise ships that have swimming pools and movie stars and I don't know whatever
Texas
else.
Tea.
That's all of those
Sorry,
things.
I'm
all
going into the wrong show.
Yeah, we save that for a different podcast. And even the retooling of the prequel franchise through Enterprise, they even made the prequel to the entire old show era more like the Next Generation era than the old show. So I think this is the only one that in my mind sort of stayed true to that general idea of the old shows, the Starfleet Battles universe.
Definitely.
And so I believe it's stayed more true ever since. And it's not just the time period of the technology, but the tone and treatment of exploration and military issues. It has a much better old show sort of sensibility to it than the new show. You know, everything is always progressively getting better and nicer, sort of idea. This world has since been republished as a D20 system. So if you like the D20 system, and I won't hate you if you do, although I'm not a huge fan of it, it's been republished as a D20 system. So you can pick up a D20 version of the Prime Directive universe and also as a GURP supplement.
Now, that's right.
If I could slingshot around the sun and go back in time and buy a different copy, I probably would have gotten the GURPS version instead, just because I really like the GURPS world book treatments. I really like having the genericness, of of the system come through in the books so that I can use the books really just as a reference for myself and not have to wade through tables of, you know, which die rolls to do in order to get my background information.
Well, yeah, those GURPS books, I mean, that, of course, is one of their was one of their design goals for GURPS, is that those world books could be used with any game system since they're generic.
I mean, that's
universal,
right.
And everything in it is defined in terms of seconds and feet and
kilometers or whatever.
And dollars, which you'd substitute for whatever the local currency is in your game and stuff like that.
Right. And although we'll talk about this a little later, the copy of Prime Directive that I have is actually the seed for the last Unicorn game Trek game that we played together. So buying this eventually led to me running that particular game.
Okay, cool.
Although we didn't actually play Prime Directive. It was Prime Directive that started off playing this other game.
Well, we will get to that in
that's
a little
right.
bit. So that's the 1993 Prime Directive game. So that was in the Starfleet Battles universe. Going back to the main Star Trek continuity.
The canonical universe, as we might call
that's
it.
That's right. The next publisher to get that license was Last Unicorn Games. And they released their Star Trek RPG game in 1998.
And I lovingly refer to this as Lug Trek.
Yes,
Last Unicorn
was,
Games, L-U-G.
That was what people called it on the nets to distinguish it from Fossa Trek, which was the previous system.
Right.
They released a core rulebook for every series. They decided to, instead of having one core rulebook and then having a source book for each series, they'd had a core rulebook for every series. So you could play just Next Generation or Deep Space Nine or the original series, and they also had ones for Vulcans, Holodeck Adventures, Klingons, Romulans, etc.
And Time Travel Adventures, even.
Did they have a time travel?
They had
travel?
A Guardian of...
Oh,
know,
the Guardian of
the
Forever
Guardian
book.
Of Forever
right.
book, and they had, you know, how to deal with time travel and all sorts
wow.
of stuff.
I could go watch Joan Collins get killed over and over,
over
again.
Over and over, yeah. The Lug Trek books were very extensive and very well written. I own a couple of them, and I really like them. And I do find it interesting that for every book they came out with, I can look back at the list of Fossa Trek books and find one that's almost exactly the same as the Fossa Trek book.
Yeah.
I guess there are so many things you can...
It's kind of a no-brainer if you have the Star Trek license to do a Klingon source book and then
right,
a Romulan
exactly.
source book, you know.
Yeah, but then you started getting into... Well, and there are obvious deficiencies in the canon. Things like, you know, how do we know how the diplomatic corps works? We really don't. We see starship captains as diplomats. How do we know how military intelligence works? We don't. So there's a... You know, so they have some wiggle room there to write about military intelligence.
That's right.
So there's a military intelligence book and so forth.
Yeah, there was a Starfleet intelligence source book also for
so
this one, I think.
And so it's almost like the theory of parallel Earths, as mentioned in Star Trek, of parallel world development, but it's parallel game book writing development.
And just people in various game companies all coming up with the same thing.
That's right.
Just all wishing they could get the license.
That's right.
So, they released source books from 1998 to 2001, so not a huge amount of time, but they did put out a lot of books in that time.
They were very prolific for only that few years.
They did. I remember seeing lots of stuff coming out. And they lost their license in 2001 to Decipher. And Decipher was previously known as a pretty big game company. They had made the Star Trek CCG, which was not the CCG based on the original series, which we talked about way back in Episode 2,
right?
But the one set in the canonical present of the Paramount Star Trek universe, which was starting with Next Generation, and they had DS9 and Voyager cards. And I had a bunch of cards. It was a pretty fun game. You had to move your ships around and,
ships and
get a crew and
complete planet.
Missions and try to thwart the other guy's missions. It was fun.
I think I have one of those. I have a KG Romulan deck, which found out to be the least powerful or interesting deck available because they lacked a number of tons of skills that were needed for all of the missions, and so
yeah.
I could only ever do half of any of the given missions because there were literally no Romulans with any of these skills.
There were so few Romulan characters presented in the show as compared
right.
to like the number of Federation characters that...
Right.
You were very limited in the decks you could build. So you had to use non-aligned characters and stuff like that. But anyway, I don't want to get into strategy for that game.
Oh, yeah, we're not going to talk about that right now. We're back to the RPGs.
So Decipher had made that game, but they picked up the Paramount RPG license in 2001. And they... So they're still the current holders of the license. They published at least six or seven books so far using their own... Coda system, which is apparently a class-based system. Now, I haven't played this one at all. I've flipped through the books at my local friendly gaming store. But, you know, I think I would like to pick up one or two of the books just to look through.
Yeah, I have no idea how this plays either. Last Unicorn Games lost their license, that's when I essentially stopped buying new role-playing games.
That's
and
right.
I wasn't interested in buying, because now, if you've been paying attention, I now have three sets of role-playing game books
that's
in the
right.
Star Trek universe.
We're looking at three piles of books
three
here.
Three piles of books, and I was not interested, since I had sort of stopped buying new role-playing game books, I was not interested in getting another collection of Star Trek role-playing game books, so I really haven't taken a look at it yet. And if you were to buy them, I'd borrow them from you.
I would lend them to
you. Okay. So let's put that on your list there.
Okay.
To do. You buy, I borrow, we're all good.
I see how this works. Okay. Now, while all these were going on, these other ones, the Starfleet Universe games were continuing to come out, as you had said. The first edition of Prime Directive, the one that you have here, proved not to be very popular, or maybe you were one of the few people to buy it.
I think I was one of, like, 12, maybe.
That's right.
I don't know.
So they republished it in two more systems, as you said, in 2002.
Because if you have a game that isn't selling well, the best thing you can do is republish it a couple of times.
Apparently so. Well, you know, they said, you know, maybe it's not the theme of Star Trek. Maybe it's the system people
maybe
don't
like. Maybe
it's
the system that people... Right.
So in 2002, they partnered with Steve Jackson Games, and they made GURPS Prime Directive, which, of course, is the skill-based GURPS system. And in 2005, just last year, they re-released it for the current GURPS 4th edition.
Ah.
And then they also made GURPS Klingon and GURPS Romulan, so you can have extra source books there.
Excellent.
And then in 2005, also Wizards of the Coast published the D20 version, as you said.
Right.
So now you have the choice of playing Star Trek with a class-based system with feats or with a skill-based system, you know? It's up to you.
That's right.
Freedom of choice.
Or you can play in the canonical universe in one of the three sort of either skill or class-based systems that they have running there, too.
That's right. You can pick and choose. And there's also a D20 Klingon, D20 Romulan books that are available. And on the Starfleet Universe website, they say that at the end of 2006, there's going to be a version of Prime Directive based on the D6 system, which was used, to my knowledge, by West End Games for their old Star Wars game, which we played a lot of.
Right. It has since been used in a couple of different games, including a DC Heroes. And,
oh, yes.
So the
and
D6 system,
and things like that.
Right. There have been a couple of different systems that use D6.
The Star Wars one is the only one I've ever played.
Right.
So anyway, there you go. We've gone over the whole list, and during the course of my gaming career, I have seen six different Star Trek RPGs
wow.
come and go. And I'm not counting the seventh one, the Heritage Games one, which I never saw. So, you know,
I've
really...
I never had heard of until
never
doing
heard
the
of.
Research.
That's right. So, you know, I remember that there was a time period when I was just saying, you know, who has the license now? Is it, what's that company? You know,
yeah,
is it FASA? Is it
LogTrack?
Is it,
am I buying an old book or a new book?
You know, it was confusing. But, you know, now we know who it is.
Compatible, so
no, they're not. Other than just, you know, general world stuff.
Right.
So I've only really played two of these, which we'll talk about next.
That's right. We're talking about the two Star Trek RPGs that we both played. Like I said, I own three. I've played two. One of them I had no intention on ever playing. The two that we played are the FASA Trek and the Lug Trek, the Last Unicorn Games Trek.
So we've really only played in the canonical universe.
Right. I've never... Well, yes and no, and I'll tell you about that in just a minute. The
okay.
one that we played in Lug Trek was highly influenced by the Prime Directive universe.
I see.
Although not actually the Prime Directive universe. It was just highly influenced by it. The first and oldest one that we played was the FASA Trek. And this one we had two different GMs, and we only managed to do... we did one session with one GM, and then, you know, two or three maybe with the other GM, and it wasn't really a regular game.
No, it was just a couple of pickup games, I think.
Yeah, it was a couple of, you know, games of, let's just do one of these sessions. It wasn't because it was a particularly bad game. It has a bunch of usability flaws, in my opinion. It just didn't work out that it was something that we wanted to run regularly or do regularly.
Yeah.
We were very episodic about it, much like the show itself.
That's right.
The first one we tried there was in the FASA game. I remember our friend Joe had picked up a copy and had showed me the books and said, I want to run one of these.
This was the same Joey who was in Episode 10, the Star Trek,
Wars
games.
The Star Wars games. There you go. The continuity between episodes. And so he picked this up and said, "Hey, I want to run one of these." And I thought it was so cool to have a Trek role playing game. I was, you know,
yeah, that was the first one we had seen.
That's right. I was, you know, raised on fantasy role playing games, and to see science fiction, especially Star Trek, I was like, you know, way excited. So I went to my local friendly neighborhood game store, Peterson Hobbies in Las Vegas, Nevada. If anyone ever remembers
that. I remember Peterson Hobbies. No longer there, I don't think.
I know. It's long since been destroyed, and now there's something like a Mongolian grill there. I don't know. But so I went to buy a copy, and the only copy they had was called the Deluxe Edition, which cost twice as much as my friend said his copy cost him. And I found out why. The Deluxe Edition was a thicker box and had included with it, well, there were essentially three editions that you could buy that were all on the shelf at the same time. Not at Peterson Hobby, where there was only one, but there were three for sale. One was the, sort of the basic. The next one was an expanded edition that had extra Games Master material, and the third one had the basic game, the expanded Games Master material, and Star Trek Tactical Combat Simulator, and a different version of Tactical Combat Simulator meant to link up to the RPG called Command and Control.
Ah, yes. Oh, so this was so that when there was a ship battle in your RPG game, you could game it out on the hex map with your ship counters.
Right. The glaring deficiency in Fast Trek, as originally presented in the starter books, is the fact that there was no spaceship rules at all. It was all about the people and the skills.
But and it was all about like landing parties and stuff you did on the planet, but nothing you did on the ship.
Right. And then they also had Tactical Combat Simulator, which they made, but those don't really connect with each other very well, and so they made essentially a glue system, a system that, you know, a shim between them that was Command and Control that would allow you to use the role-playing game skill stats in order to make certain things happen in the Star Trek Tactical Combat Simulator game. So, and I've never played that particular one, and I wouldn't inflict it on anybody because it seemed just a little, you know, too many steps, I guess.
Yeah.
It sort of went afoul of my usual desire for efficiency went against there. So Command and Control is a system where all the PCs who were supposed to be bridge members actually controlled their portion of the ship. The engineer had to make skill rolls in order to allocate power, and the captain had to make tactics roles in order to get initiative in the battle. And so everything that you would do playing this sort of starship combat game, like, oh, I'm going to make my roll to hit with the phasers, a character would have to use their, you know, phaser weapon skill separately in order to do that.
And now, as you describe this, that's reminding me kind of battle stations.
Oh yeah, it's similar to
except
that.
Except without the running around the ship and fixing things.
Running around the ship is actually half the fun, I think, of battle stations. In Command and Control, you actually just got a bunch of pieces of paper, 8.5 by 11 pieces of paper that had, you know, sort of a mock-up of what your control station was supposed to look like, and you moved chits along your power line, and Anyway, it was. I don't know. It was a valiant attempt to put a shim in between these two very incompatible systems.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, we spent a lot of time with these making our characters. And if I remember correctly, the very first time we played and we made our characters, we just made two guys and had them fight.
The standard test that we always apply to every new RPG.
That's right. You get a new RPG, you make two guys, and you have them fight. And I don't even think we had them fight NPCs or, you know, a random monster from Planet 12. I think we just had them fight each other. So we just said, okay, we're all PCs. We're going to fight each other. We're going to see how this works.
An Andorian captain and a Vulcan science officer just duking it out.
That's
for
right,
no apparent
duking it
reason.
Out on the, you know, on the bridge. And then we were doing all sorts of experiments, like, what if I turn the phaser up to 10 instead of 8? How much faster would this battle go? Anyway, so we did that, and we spent a lot of time making the characters. And looking back at it, that was actually the funnest part of the whole game.
It was just the character creation.
The character creation was three-quarters of the fun I ever got out of that game. And this is where I go into my first major digression about the Facetrex character creation system.
Oh, yes.
So go get yourself a cup of coffee, and sit back, put up your feet. No, So let me tell you a little bit about it and why it was so interesting. Okay. First of all, you get your stats for your character. You know, their strength, their intelligence, and there's one for luck. And they happen to make Vulcans who are cool in strength and cool in intelligence really, really unlucky, which I think is great.
That's why we never see them at the casinos.
That's right. And so you get some of these, and then you get skills for your life background pre-Starfleet. You know, if you grew up on an agricultural world and backwater world, you'd have a certain set of skills. You had your essentially primary and secondary education skills that you'd get. And then you would send your character to Starfleet Academy and get more skills or stat bonuses with your time there, and your age ticks up a little bit. And you do some rolls to see how well you did, and you apply bonuses or negatives as appropriate. So you find out how well you did in school.
Ah.
And then you go
The fun of going to school in RPG form.
That's right, all in a couple of rolls, too. Hey, if I could have gotten through high school with a couple of percentile rolls, that would have been great. And then you go on your cadet cruise, and again, you get certain skill improvements for your cadet cruise, and you make a couple of rolls to see how your commanding officer rated you. Now, notice that no actual role-playing has yet occurred, and yet your character has gone all the way through Starfleet Academy and has gone on their first cadet cruise.
Does it have a table for how they handled the Kobayashi Maru test?
It doesn't, but they should have, because that's an integral part of this. Actually, the Kobayashi Maru, if we're going to get technical, should come later in this series, because that would be part of Command School.
Oh, yes, you're right.
So, and we'll get to Command School in just a second.
I insist we get technical.
Okay, we will get technical. So if you don't do well in your cadet cruise, you have to redo it. And there's a part on the character sheet for how many times you can go through the cadet cruise. And it's like 5 times, that you can go through it. And by the time you've gone through 5 times, you get a bonus for going on a second cadet cruise. So it's harder to screw up. And if you go on a third cadet cruise, it's even harder to screw up. And by the time you get 5, it becomes impossible not to graduate the cadet cruise.
They're like, you're done here. You're no longer a cadet.
That's right.
We've held you back too many times.
That's right. And your character becomes a freshly minted ensign. Or if your cadet cruise was spectacular, you might be a lieutenant junior grade or something like that. You may get a promotion out of it. Really unlikely. I think it's a 5% chance that happens. But now is when you make a decision about your character's destiny.
Oh, I know. Destiny.
The thing is they don't actually say as much in the rules, like decide your destiny, but there is a table that says if your character is destined to be a captain, then if they're destined to be a bridge executive officer, then...
This game has a very Calvinist worldview.
It kind of does. So at this point, you're actually deciding. Once you get through this point, you don't actually have to decide anything about your character except generally what they're going to school for and how you want to do it. And now you're deciding, are we actually going to play as freshly minted ensigns, or are we going to play as, the bridge crew? Are we going to have a captain? And if so, this makes a difference as to how much more character creation you go through. So, of course, we all decided, hey, we are bridge officers, so therefore we get many more steps of character creation come from this. So you figure out if, for example, they're going to see, this decision makes a difference how many tours of duty your character will now undergo before you actually start playing. Still, no role-playing involved up to this point.
Still just rolling on tables in the book.
Right, still rolling on tables in the book. And you also find out if you need to go to command school and learn about the Kobayashi Maru, or if you need to take some advanced training like graduate school in some particular field like medicine. And so, for example, if the character is going to be a captain, he needs to go to command school, and he'll get skill bonuses for Federation law and administration and tactics, and he'll have a minimum number of tours of duty that he has to take, and each one of those tours he has to pass with a certain completion rating. And for each tour of duty, your character gets older. So as you start going up in age, and you maybe get promotions for your tours of duty, you get bucket loads of skill points, but you also suffer stat reductions for age. And so you end up with a 50-year-old captain who's not as spry as everybody else, but he has lots of skills and is well-ranked.
I see.
And they actually make a note that they say Captain Kirk is the odd duck in this particular system for being so young and so highly placed and, in fact, so skilled.
Did they make a note that you cannot generate Captain Kirk by rolling on the tables in that book?
Yes, they did. They said none of
that. Because he's just so far above everyone else.
Right, and they said they give stats for all of the main characters, the bridge crew in the old show, and they pretty much tell you, don't worry about trying to get any of these. You really can't generate these people, using this system.
The characters you make will never be as good.
They'll never be as good.
You're all going to be mediocre Federation.
You'll always be second banana to Spock, let me tell you. So each tour of duty type, though, is different and will give you different sorts of skill bonuses. If your tour of duty is on a combat frigate, then you get different bonuses than teaching at Starfleet Academy for a tour of duty.
Ah, yes.
So altogether, when you're done and you've gone through the number of tours of duty that you need to get to the your destined rank or the rank that you're going to start as, you have a set of skills that would be appropriate for someone not only your age, but also your background and work history and your rank.
Well, sounds good. So your character is just, you know, completely appropriate to their whole background.
That's right.
Or more like you get a whole background automatically generated when you have this character.
Right. And you can go in and fill in all the details you like. For example, I had the character that I hadn't played with a couple of times was a Vulcan science officer. You know, that was so original. A Vulcan science officer.
I know. Where'd you come up with that?
I don't know. That was, like, so out there. Anyway, in looking at his history, I lined it up with the online Usenet FAQ of the official Star Trek timeline to find out, well, you know, what has he lived through? What has he seen?
Ah.
And, oh, he was at Starfleet. And I had one where he was... His tour of duty was at a research station during the time that isolinear chips in computer science were created, and my guy happened to hit, you know, super expert rating in computer science right then. So I just told the GM, my guy invented isolinear chips because I happened to be there at the same time that isolinear chips happened to be created.
And it's because of you, we can only have 640K worth of memory on the Starship.
That's right. Anyway, I really liked the fleshing out of the background of the characters. It was a lot of fun to say, oh, his second cruise was in the Merchant Marines, and so he gets extra skill in carousing, which is an actual skill, carousing.
Carousing.
Kirk had a great carousing.
I imagine he hardly ever failed to carouse.
he never failed to carouse.
Whenever he went out, he always never had a bad time.
That's right. He never botched his carouse skill. And so, oh, he's in the Merchant Marine, so he gets streetwise and carousing. Oh, no, but he's on a frigate and after that. And as you go through different tours of duty, your chance of having a more prestigious placement actually goes up, and your chance of getting the number of advancements that you need in rank in order to get to your destined rank actually goes up. It's pretty good. And so... my digression on the creation is complete now. We go back to what we're talking about. So the time that we actually played this game in a narrative way, instead of just making characters, which was
almost as
exciting as doing this, was with our friend Ed as a games master.
Yeah.
And he did about two sessions with you and some other people and two sessions with me and some others, and we overlapped maybe one of those sessions.
I only played one with you.
Oh,
yes.
You only played one? Yeah, we overlapped like one. And I want you to tell the listening public a little bit about your missions with Ed.
Well, I don't remember a whole lot about my missions with Ed.
Guys got a good carousing role.
Well, for some reason, I remember that we all decided we were all going to be captains.
Yeah, which I think, actually, I would like to digress from this just a second, too. I think this actually solves one of the biggest problems with a military type or a Star Trek type game, is that there is a chain of command, and people don't like to be ordered around by their buddy. And their buddy might be a higher rank but be lower prestige in the actual geek group. And so who would actually want to follow rules from Stinky in the corner who happened to get the role to be commander and you're only lieutenant? And I think by making everybody a captain, I think that solved one of the problems.
Maybe.
In a very ham-fisted way, but it solved one
maybe
of the problems.
Maybe that's what Ed was trying to do. I don't remember what it was, but I remember about it. So I had a captain... was named Captain Vangelis Papathanasioli. He was a Greek.
Fine Greek stock.
That's right. And that name actually is the name of a musician. He's the guy who did the Chariots of Fire theme, if you've heard that.
He's just called Vangelis, though, isn't he?
He is, but his last name is actually Papathanasioli.
Okay.
You can see why he doesn't put that on the album cover.
I can see why he'd have to go have an extended LP.
He would.
He couldn't do it on a CD.
So we all had really tried to make up really eccentric characters. So Scott had a captain who was just continuously reading comic books while on the con.
Yeah.
And Jonathan had a guy who was always chewing tobacco and spitting on the bridge.
And they had to have the yeoman come in and clean it up.
That's right. And I had Captain Vangelis Papathanasioli, and he had such a big ego that he would only allow himself to be referred to, not just as... Captain, but you'd always call him Captain Vangelis Papathanasioli.
So. Sir, the engines can't take it anymore, Captain Vangelis Papathanasioli.
That's right. And so I accepted a degradation in the reaction speed of my bridge crew because they had to relay all the information about, like, the shields had gone down with an extra 4 seconds of speech.
That's great.
And you, I think, were in this game, except you were one of the few that did not want to have a captain for some reason.
Right. I think I was a deckhand.
You were a... Well, no, you had a Vulcan science officer, right?
Oh, yeah. That's... Well, was that the same... It was. It was the same character.
Was
I never,
it the same
I always
game?
Only ever played the same character. No, well... We'll get to the ignoble death of my Vulcan science officer in a minute, but yeah, I was just a Vulcan science officer, and they just always asked me to check the sensors, and I had to repeat back to them what it was.
So
and I didn't want to be captain. I stayed whatever my grade was because I had this great background that I'd already rolled up, and I wasn't about to to ruin that just for Ed. So
we were all playing it really funny, and I think Ed was trying to be more serious.
Yes.
He had a
but
specific.
But how can you expect that? We're having captains all over the place.
I don't know. I think one of us was an admiral and was lording it over one of the other captains on his own.
And
bridge.
Everybody else was called commodore because that's what you call a captain who's not in command of the
ship. That's right.
On.
They were all commodores. I don't even remember what the mission was. It was something to do with Romulans that were attacking a planet, and Ed had a certain solution in mind that we were supposed to know.
Right.
Because it had been mentioned in one show.
Right.
And this was that the Romulans were hiding over the magnetic pole of the planet.
Right.
And they were cloaked, and so we couldn't detect them.
But you were supposed to be able to detect them by doing a science check or whatever on the magnetic pole of the planet.
That's
looking
right.
For cloaked vessels, then you could find that the ions were going around the vessel somehow.
So he had seen this in some episode, and he was just waiting. That was we were not going to do anything until one of us came up with that solution, which
right.
None of us had any idea what that was.
No,
so
no.
I think we all died.
Right.
And you had decided to beam down to the, or you had to go down to the planet, your character, to
right.
Solve some problem on the planet. I don't even remember what it was.
Yeah.
There was a lot of ion storms, and they said that there was like a 5% chance that you would survive if you beamed down to the planet. And what Ed intended was that you would do that anyway and get down there and heroically save the day or something.
Right, right.
And you, being a logical science officer, said, no, with that chance of success, I'm going to take a shuttle down.
Yeah, because the shuttle was like 85% chance of making it down. So logically, as a Vulcan science officer, I decided, well, I'm taking the shuttle down. I'm not going to.
And so you did, and the Romulan shot down the shuttle. And
that's right. The ignoble death of my... of the science officer for, in fact, being logical and doing what he would have done in that case. This particular game showed a major disconnect in between... It highlights a disconnect that there often is in role-playing games between the knowledge that the players have and the knowledge that the characters should have.
That's right. And I don't know.
Because you would think, I was a science officer, ran sensors all day, and I had this huge, massive intelligence and this brain bulging out of my forehead. And so I'm like, well, what can I do? And he's like, well, what do you want to do? And I'm like, I want to find the most logical, interesting way, or the most likely way of finding a cloaked vessel. And he's like, well, what do you do? And I just couldn't come up with it because Nate, do not have a giant Vulcan pulsing forehead able to do this sort of thing. So I
hope I'm not overly trashing Ed and his Game Master skills.
Oh, we still
Ed, love Ed, if you're listening there, I offer you the free chance to have a rebuttal here.
That's right.
If you'd like to present your side of the story here, please let me know and we'll play some sound file from you.
Absolutely.
So,
do it, Ed. We dare you. I'd love to hear from Ed. I hope he actually writes in.
So the next game we played was Lug Trek, which was the last Unicorn Games one. So, Nate, tell
yes.
us about that one.
Oh, yes.
And you ran this one.
This is the one that I ran. I GM'd this game, and I pretty much thought it would be a one-shot, although I kept it open with the idea that it might possibly turn out to be something more. But at the time, none of us were really role-playing gaming regularly. So
yeah,
I didn't
just
hold
sort
out.
Of a reason to get together and have some fun.
Right, right. There wasn't a whole lot of hope that this would go beyond our one shot. So we made a bunch of characters. Now, I had recently read Starship Troopers by Robert Heinlein.
Ah, yes, one of your favorites.
Well, yes, since then it's been one of my favorite sci-fi books. And I wondered how ground-pounding troops would play in the next generation's Navy officer heavy world.
That's right.
They spend a lot of time up in the ship on the deck ordering other people to do things and not a lot of time actually, well, other than away missions.
But not a lot of time conducting major combat operations.
Right. They almost never conduct major combat operations. All the landing things are little two-minute skirmishes, and then they beam out. And then they're back, you know, drinking coffee and going to plays or whatever it is that they do up on the ship. And this was actually brought out in Starship Troopers. In the book, Starship Troopers, they make a point of, say, well, there's a difference between the, you know, the infantry who's being carried by this particular Navy ship and then the Navy people. And the Navy people live this totally different sort of life because they spend all their time in the ship, and the Marines spend most of their time down on the planet and only end up in the ship when they're going from planet to planet, from combat operation to combat operation. So I scooped up my copy of Prime Directive to get some ideas, because Prime Directive, if anything, is a ground pounder game.
Oh, yes.
You know, it really is not so much about what's happening on the ship, although that stuff is there, and although they have all the rules that are there, there are way more rules on grenade scattering and all sorts of other stuff, partial cover, than there are, you know, on larger ship and diplomatic issues.
Like any game with rules for partial cover, you know there's going to be some,
that's right.
Some combat.
And I tell you, this game, it's set in the old show, and so it's phasers ablazing, you know, sort of action going on. And so I had the characters make red shirts, who were not in the Navy chain of command, but were part of a ground troop force, sort of like an army-like entity or the Marines, some other arm of the United Federation of Planets that deals with ground operations, which we don't really see in Star Trek a lot. They just, you know,
do lots
of stuff from orbit.
They did have a couple episodes of Deep Space Nine where they showed the sort of Marine troops.
Oh, there you go. And I must have missed those.
Yeah, I should tell you. I'll find out which episode that is.
I'll grab them. Well, and they also sort of showed that in Enterprise with the...
Yes, they did, because they had the Marines who would come in and save the day. What do they call them? I can't remember now.
I don't remember, and now we're going to be flogged for this, but especially after saying we're big Star Trek fans. But since I don't consider Enterprise canon, then I guess maybe... So I'm sort of a... I'm absolved from knowing this. Anyway, so I decided to make them these red shirts. So these were ground forces. They were Marines. They were garrison troops on the Navy vessels, and the Navy vessels were there to transport and deploy them to different combat operations where they were supposed to be. They were regular military. I had them have a real chain of command. They weren't. None of them were officers. They were all squaddies, corporals, and there was one that was a sergeant NCO, a non-commissioned officer. And their commanding officer, who was an actual commissioned officer, spent time coordinating with the Starfleet Navy crew on the ship.
Oh, yeah.
And so that's the person that did the mission briefings and debriefings. And generally, I tried to run it slightly differently than you would see in Star Trek itself. This is not the security team led by Commander Worf. These are actual professional soldiers who do combat operations.
Oh, yeah. The name of the soldiers in Enterprise, they were the Makos.
The Makos.
Military Assault Command Operations.
Oh, there you go.
And not the Bakos. That's a solid salad topping. These are the Makos.
Those are a tasty salad topping. These are the Makos. Almost like the sharks, right? Isn't there?
Yes, in fact, their patch has a Mako shark on it.
Oh, well, there you go.
Just look that up.
There you go. Thank you. So I scripted out this story, and it's kind of funny because I ran across this script in preparing for the podcast.
Oh, you have the actual script here.
I do. I have the actual script right here in my hot little hand. And I sort of said it, you know, I have Act 1, Episode 1, Uneasy Alliance, Stardate, and Act 1, The Dirty Work. And so I set this sort of background and had them go into it, and they got their mission briefing from their officer and then went to go do the mission. I don't know if anyone's actually interested in what the mission was about, so I'm wondering if I should even go into this.
I'll just mention a couple of things I remember from this, so we don't want to go into the whole story.
Right.
And then I rolled, and I barely made that roll.
Right. Let's not do that.
But what I remember is I had a Vulcan guy, Vulcan squaddy, and I remember we got into the ground, and there were some guys that had some information that we needed to know. And I think I had just seen... Star Trek VI, maybe, was the one where they go to where Kirk and Spock get sent to the prison planet. I think that was Repente.
Yeah.
Yeah, because that was the one right before Generations.
Right.
So Star Trek VI, and there's a scene where this one Vulcan chick has some information that Spock needs to know, and so he just goes up and rips it out of her mind.
Oh, that's right. No, actually, wait. It was Undiscovered Country.
Undiscovered Country.
Yeah, Undiscovered Country. There was the Vulcan who was played by Kim Cattrall.
Yes, Kim Cattrall.
Right, absolutely.
The mannequin.
From Mannequin. That's, and from Sex and the City, most recently.
Oh, okay. I'm much more familiar with Mannequin.
Honestly, I am, too.
So he goes and he rips the information out of her mind, and it's this very tense scene there. So I had just seen that, and I was like, wow, I want to do that. So
all right.
We had captured these guys who were soldiers of the enemy, and so I had my guy just go do some very un-Vulcan-like things.
Right. Go. That's right. Well, you're a soldier. You're a Vulcan soldier, right?
Apparently so.
Yeah, and I actually found the character sheets in looking through this as well for the different people, and indeed that matches your description of what you could do.
See, there it is.
So we did that, and we had a Betazoid who was the sort of the not communications officer. He was an actual squatty, but he had a bunch of telepathy powers that he used in order to more efficiently conduct combat operations.
And then it was so that we could speak silently while we were raiding people.
That's right. He was running. No, I actually do think he was running relay of mental telepathy, so that you didn't have to use the regulation communicators, which apparently aren't encrypted in any way. But so there were a bunch, and there was an Andorian, and so everyone had a different character, and essentially they were all these squatties, and they ran about conducting this military and reconnaissance operation. And I thought it was really great. I had a lot of fun running it. I had a great time running it. I had a great time because it was Trek and not Trek. In fact, it was what I believe the spirit of the Prime Directive universe without actually having to play with the copy of Prime Directive that I had.
Oh, yeah. It was fun. I enjoyed it a lot.
And I also got to play. I got to touch a little bit of Starship Troopers in there, and I got the touch of Trek and the touch of Prime Directive, and I thought it was really good. I had such a great time running the game. I think there are a lot of interesting stories and adventures that could be told in the Star Trek universe from the perspective of the Mudfoot, that perspective, rather than the perspective of the top of the tower with the bombarding. Mm-hmm. The orbital ship that just knows orbital bombardment and 30-second skirmishes on the ground while everyone emergency beams out.
Yep, definitely.
And so it was a lot of fun, and I quite enjoyed it. And would I run it again? Well, absolutely, given all the the caveats of time and money and
you could get all of us together.
And I could get
again.
All the people that I like to play with together again. Sure, would I round up random random people from the high school or college? No. Don't think I'd do that, but
no one's asking you to round up random high schoolers to play with.
Why don't I just write the great American Star Trek novel? Because I don't think anybody has ever written any Star Trek novels, and I could probably do. Oh wait, no, people have.
No, I think there's a few out there.
I could
there.
Do. Tell you what I could do is I could do a Star Trek musical based on this because I don't think there are any Star Trek musicals.
I'm sure someone will write in and tell us about Star Trek.
In which case,
musical.
I'm interested in knowing about it. Because I think that would be cool.
Wow.
Anyway, so yeah, we had a chance to play Last Unicorn Games Trek, sort of. I mean, it was using that same system. It was using their character creation system and everything, but the world was slightly modified, and the point of view of the players was slightly modified, and I enjoyed that.
No, it was great. It was great.
So there we have it. Those are the two games that we've played.
And that's the history of Star Trek RPGs.
Yep. Star Trek RPG licenses and you. Go out and buy one today.
That's right, which I guess would have to be the Decipher one.
Right. Unless you go to eBay.
Go to eBay. Lots of good stuff still out there.
That's right.
Hey, Nate and Adam, it's Joey. I heard you guys were going to be talking about Star Trek Tactical Combat Simulator, and who'd have known that a night filled with math and paperwork would be such a blast? That's got to be one of my all-time favorite games. Thanks for introducing it to me, and I hope to play it many more times in the future with you guys. Talk to you later. Take care.
Oh, Okay, that's the show, and we are out of here. We'll be back in 2d6 times n days.
Where n is a heretofore unknown positive integer. We invite you to figure out what it's going to be.
Yes.
In the meantime, if you want to contact us, you can send email to roll2d6@gmail.com, or you can post a comment on the roll2d6.com blog.
Please do. We love reading those. And stay tuned next time when you might hear Nate say,
"Sir, he stayed at his post." I love that line.
That is a lovely accent. All right. See you next time.